Authentic is sponsored in whole by Voice of Prophecy.
Something I saw on social media a while ago suddenly blew up into this massive controversy, and you'll never guess what it was. Today on Authentic, I'm going to tell you what I learned from the Mole Man.
Welcome to Authentic. Sean Boonstra explores real existential questions about the meaning of your life and how you can live a genuine human existence. Listen every week right here on this station or on your favorite podcatcher. Here's Sean with this week's episode of Authentic.
A little while ago, I stumbled onto this debate on social media that kept my attention for way longer than it should have. It first showed up on another forum, but of course, somebody took a screenshot and shared it with the whole world. Such is the nature of the internet. It was a heartbroken plea from a woman whose boyfriend was doing something she didn't care for. And while I'm tempted to summarize this for the sake of expediency, I think the only way to accurately convey the sense of it is to just read it to you. So here we go. I believe this was dated sometime in April of 2022. It says, "So I know this is a weird question, but my boyfriend likes to spend a lot of his free time digging a tunnel on some property that he inherited. I haven't seen the full extent of it, but last I saw it was remarkably deep under the surface. He spent roughly a year on it, and it's evident. The front of the thing is deep, wide, well put together. At the front, which is the only part I've seen, he's got cement beams, electric lights, even chairs and a small table. I haven't gone into it, but it looks like the quality severely dropped as the tunnel went further, mostly becoming open dirt with some wood beams holding it up. My biggest concern is his safety. I'm really worried that he's going to dig too deep and it'll collapse on him or something. I've tried voicing this concern to him, but he just laughs it off and assures me that he'll be fine. Aside from safety concerns, there's also the fact that he doesn't really have a social life because of this thing. I'm pretty much the only person he still talks to outside of his job, and he doesn't go out and do anything anymore. It used to be that he'd occasionally head out and do some digging on the weekends, but now he spends almost all of his free time out there. He still comes home, but he barely spends any time with me. And I know that he isn't doing anything but digging that darned hole in the ground. This can't be good for his mental health, but I don't know how to convince him to stop." And now comes the kicker. "He's always really happy when he comes back from digging, which is why I haven't seriously tried to stop him before. But I was talking to a friend about him, and she told me he might be going crazy. Obviously, I don't think he's insane, but I hadn't considered the mental health aspect of this, and I just don't know what to do." Now, this is not the kind of thing I'd normally waste my time on, but you have to admit, this kind of stirs your imagination. I mean, what in the world is that boyfriend looking for? Does he think there's something valuable under the property? Is he some kind of a prepper digging himself a shelter so he can survive the collapse of civilization? Or is there a possibility, and I know this isn't nice, but I also know this absolutely popped into some of your heads, is there a possibility that he's out there digging that tunnel just to get away from her? Gotta wonder. You know what my first reaction was? I wish I had a tunnel I could work on. And not because I need to get away from my wife. In fact, I hit the jackpot in the wife department. But there's just something really appealing about what that guy was doing. It doesn't really matter if the tunnel actually goes anywhere or if it serves any kind of practical purpose. The joy is in the digging. And while some of you are going to wonder about my sanity today, some of you understand what I'm talking about. Not too far down the gargantuan thread of posts that followed that one, somebody inserted a cartoon with two women talking. One says to the other, "My boyfriend won't stop digging his tunnel," and her friend replies, "Boys are weird." But then in the next panel, there are two men, and one asks the other, "You want to dig?" And his friend says, "Yes!" exclamation point. It made me laugh because I'm absolutely the friend who says, "Yes." Now, what I'm going to say is a little simplistic. It's a massive generalization. But this whole thing does illustrate a fundamental difference between the way sexes tend to think about life. For thousands of years, men have scratched their heads trying to figure out how women think. And for thousands of years, women have been doing the same thing in the other direction. And I realize we can find lots of overlap between the sexes and clear exceptions to the rule when we examine the whole population. So don't write me letters. But for the most part, there are definite trends. and the evident differences between the sexes have been a nonstop source of frustration and entertainment on both sides of the fence. I mean, I've been living with Jean for about 3 decades now, so I can pretty much predict what she's going to do under any given circumstance. I know my wife's bedtime routine like the back of my hand. It involves no less than 20 separate activities, and she always does all of them in exactly the same order every single night. I know exactly what she's going to do and when she's going to do it. But I've got to tell you this. To this day, I have no idea why. All of it makes perfect sense to her, but not to me. As you can imagine, the thread below this lady's post exploded with comments because I'm not the only one who found this subject irresistible. And for the most part, the responses were predictable. Most of the women condemned the tunnel and sympathized with the girlfriend. Not all of them, but most of them. A handful simply said, if he's coming home happy all the time, what's wrong with that? Now, most of the men were decidedly in favor of the tunnel, reminding us that for men, physical work is therapy. Most of us don't want to sit in a circle and share our feelings or bare our souls to another human being. I know that some of you are convinced that men would like it if we tried, but I can assure you, we do not. Not everybody deals with problems the same way. For example, in the winter, when I'm really frustrated about something, I like to go outside and shovel snow. Sometimes I'll even move a pile of heavy wet snow just a few feet because there's something about being physically active and doing orderly routine work that helps you make sense out of your thoughts. This is likely the reason I like to read books when I'm walking, which is something I discovered the founder of this show, The Voice of Prophecy, also did. It takes a little practice to master walking and reading, and I'd advise a great deal of caution if you're going to do it. But I love it, because when I'm active and my blood gets pumping, my thoughts become sharper and better organized. Now, for the most part, I find that social media threads are a waste of my time, and they're largely a festival of uninformed opinions. But sometimes, all of those throwaway comments you find under a post begin to reveal something true about human nature. One of the respondents suggested that men have a deep need to control their environment, and personal experience suggests to me that he's right. And when we can't control our environment, we'll naturally go find something we can control so that we can begin to find order in the midst of chaos. The same is true for many women, as my wife pointed out, and she puts knitting in that category. It's a somewhat mindless activity, but it's systematic, so it gives a troubled mind a much-needed sense of order. And as soon as I return from the chaos of a really quick break, I'll tell you something surprising and useful about post-traumatic stress disorder and a video game I'm guessing you've played at some point.
Life can throw a lot at us. Sometimes we don't have all the answers. But that's where the Bible comes in. It's our guide to a more fulfilling life. Here at The Voice of Prophecy, we've created the Discover Bible Guides to be your guide to the Bible. They're designed to be simple, easy to use, and provide answers to many of life's toughest questions. And they're absolutely free. Sign up at BibleStudies.com today and start your journey of discovery.
This is Authentic with Sean Boonstra and The Voice of Prophecy.
2,000 years ago, the Roman statesman and luminary Seneca wrote to his mother about the incredibly stressful events she'd been going through. He didn't write to her right away, he said, because sometimes discussing trauma too early only makes things worse. Here's what he wrote. I realized that your grief should not be intruded upon while it was fresh and agonizing. In the case, the consolations themselves should rouse and inflame it. For an illness, too, nothing is more harmful than premature treatment. So I was waiting until your grief of itself should lose its force, and being softened by time to endure remedies, it would allow itself to be touched and handled. You know, if you think about it, he kind of has a point. When something really devastating happens, at least for me, the last thing I want to do is talk about it. In fact, I often find myself turning down phone calls from people who really just want to help me feel better. I mean, I know they mean well, but discussing the problem with somebody when it's really fresh is sometimes a frustrating exercise because I haven't had time to sort things out in my head. One of the problems with traumatic events is that your brain just doesn't know where to file the information. And so you find it haunting your thoughts day after day, hour after hour, on an endless feedback loop that can really start to torture you. And when somebody wants to talk in the earliest moments of your torment, it doesn't usually help. I'm not saying it doesn't help anybody, but it certainly doesn't help me. And I'm guessing that's also true for a lot of you. Ask me again in a couple of months, and chances are I'll be far more ready to talk, because by then I'll have figured out where to file the information, and now it's organized. Now, I don't really know this guy, but I'm guessing that it's at least part of the reason that Mole Man is down there underground excavating a tunnel. It's a way of organizing your thoughts, even though the dirt and the shovel might be unrelated to the problems you're actually thinking about. Back in 2017, a group of researchers from the UK and Sweden discovered something really interesting about traumatic events. When victims of a car accident were given a game of Tetris to play within the first few hours of the trauma, it greatly reduced the potential for PTSD, even if all they did was play the game for 20 minutes. A psychology professor by the name of Emily Holmes found these studies promising, as reported in this online article published by CPR News, which said, Holmes feels that playing Tetris shortly after an accident can interfere with memory consolidation, or the gradual conversion of short-term memories into more permanent ones. Evidence suggests that there is a window following a trauma in which a bad memory can be disrupted or avoided, and in which memories can be uncoupled from the brain's emotional centers. Now, I'm certainly not a qualified psychologist by any stretch of the imagination. And as an amateur, I know just enough to be a little dangerous. But honestly, this research does make sense to me. Quite apart from the fact that I could hear the Tetris music playing in my head when I read that story, and you're welcome because you can probably hear it now too. Apart from that, this research struck a chord with me. It makes a lot of sense. In fact, I've been in a few car wrecks, including a bad one that I caused when I was just a few days shy of my 17th birthday. For the next few weeks, every time I closed my eyes, I saw nothing but car accident. I could see the moment the car became airborne. I could hear the screams of my passengers and hear the horrible sound of steel grinding against steel. And I could feel the impact when the car was stopped by a tree at the bottom of a cliff. And in the beginning, it felt like that playback loop was never, ever going to stop. It was an experience that was so unusual, so out of step with my day-to-day life, that my brain didn't know what to do with it. I mean, if you ask a stuntman if his dreams are haunted by his work, the answer's probably no, unless there was something particularly horrible when somebody was hurt or killed. But for the most part, this is what these guys do every single day, so they can sleep comfortably at night. Their world makes perfect sense. But crashing cars was not what I do on a daily basis, and so the memory haunted me. The scenes appeared on the stage of my mind uncontrollably, re-emerging when I least expected it. I had no way to make sense of them. I mean, over time, the problem went away. But there are people whose trauma continues to haunt them for many, many years. And from where I sit, and remember, I'm not an expert, but from where I sit, it seems like part of the problem is that we just don't know what to do with the information. And that's where a game of Tetris really makes sense. I mean, think about it. A game like Tetris requires you to make order out of chaos. Tetris is a game where geometric shapes are falling out of the sky and you have to rotate and guide them so that they all fit together like puzzle pieces at the bottom of the screen. Again, it's order out of chaos. And while the chaos you faced in real life isn't quite like that, your brain can still sense that you're working on it, that you're restoring order, and maybe, just maybe, the act of organizing random blocks puts your random thoughts into some kind of order as well, because your brain thinks it's finally dealing with it. It's not unlike the notepad I keep close to my bed. I've been a horrible sleeper my whole life, and one of the things that disrupts my sleep on a regular basis is unfinished business. A random thought will pop into my head in the middle of the night, reminding me of an unfinished task. And of course, at 2 o'clock in the morning, there's not much I can do about it. I can't make a phone call and ask someone to help me, and I can't call a meeting to discuss the problem with staff. And so it haunts me, like a broken tooth at the back of my mouth that my tongue just can't stop playing with. So what do? I write it down. It might be as simple as writing, ask Ruben about our production schedule, or ask Kyle when he needs the details for the brochure we're going to produce. And then the minute I write it down, my brain marks it as handled and lets go of it. So maybe doing something like Tetris convinces your brain that you've handled the issue and it can begin to relax. You might not be able to walk away from the problem, but at least now you've done something and your mind begins to perceive a little more order. Now, of course, I really have no idea why Mr. Mole Man is actually under the ground digging, but I can tell you that it appeals to me simply because that looks like my kind of therapy. Which brings me to the Bible, because it has a lot to say about the subject of worry. There's a well-loved expression in one of Peter's letters, and it reads like this. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time, casting all your care upon him, for he cares for you. The Greek word for care is merimna, and it literally means anxiety. This was written at a time when the Roman Empire was just becoming aware of the existence of Christians, and the emperor didn't like them. Peter died, in fact, under the reign of Nero, who took special delight in killing Christians in very inventive and diabolical ways. He had some of them sewn into animal skins and dropped in front of a hungry pack of dogs. There were others that he dipped in tar and hung from crosses so that he could light them on fire and use them as nightlights in the arena. It was a very stressful time to be a Christian, and you can be sure there was no shortage of trauma that believers suffered. And how does Peter suggest they handle it? By releasing their cares to God. And I'll be right back after this break to talk about that.
Here at the Voice of Prophecy, we're committed to creating top-quality programming for the whole family, like our audio adventure series, Discovery Mountain. Discovery Mountain is a Bible-based program for kids of all ages. Your whole family will enjoy the faith-building stories from this small mountain summer camp and town. With 24 seasonal episodes every year and fresh content every week, there's always a new adventure just on the horizon. Check it out today at discoverymountain.com.
This is Authentic with Sean Boonstra and the Voice of Prophecy.
Sometimes the advice that Christians like to give each other during really trying times isn't really very helpful. It's a little like Job's friends who came to help him grieve his incredible loss. These guys really meant well, but what they were doing with the things they said was kind of heaping salt into his wounds. I mean, statements like, Job, have you considered that this is probably your fault? That's not particularly helpful when somebody's hurting, because trust me, hurting people have already considered that. I've discovered over the years that people are usually afraid to go and visit somebody who has suffered incredible loss because, well, they don't know what to say. So let me put your mind at ease. I can tell you, after decades of sitting with grieving families, it's not what you say that matters nearly as much as the fact that you showed up. Unless, of course, you say something really hurtful, which I promise you, they will remember. And often when the wound is fresh, saying less actually proves to be more. I mean, that's exactly what Seneca wrote to his mother. I would have written sooner, but I didn't want to make things worse. So sometimes, as my wife can tell you, I really don't want to talk about things when I'm troubled by them. But I will talk to God, and I don't always have the words to express what I'm feeling. And in that case, I fall back on something I found in Romans chapter 8, where Paul says this, listen, likewise, the Spirit also helps in our weaknesses, for we do not know what we should pray for as we ought, but the Spirit himself makes intercession for us with groanings which cannot be uttered. So in other words, it doesn't matter if I don't have the vocabulary to express what I'm feeling, because God does. He knows full well what it's like to live here on this planet, because he's been here and he struggled to the point of actually sweating blood in the Garden of Gethsemane. Listen to what the author of the book of Hebrews tells us about Jesus. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. The Bible reveals a personal God who gets us because He's not a stranger to suffering. He entered this chaotic world of ours, a world that made no sense, a world that was ripped apart by trauma, and He made sense out of it. And then He invites you to share what's killing you, to bring those haunting thoughts that refuse to stop torturing you and share them with Him. Cast your cares upon Him, Peter writes, because He cares for you. And sometimes when the pain is too deep for words, when my voice begins to falter because I don't know how to handle what I'm talking about, I actually take out my laptop and I begin to write. And I address it to God as if it was an email that He was going to receive in a matter of seconds. And wouldn't you know it, there's just something about the very act of organizing my thoughts and presenting them to somebody bigger than myself that begins to melt my anxiety. My brain actually begins to let go of it because it senses that I'm dealing with it. I take those thoughts and I put them somewhere by the act of placing them in God's hands. You know, I'm suddenly reminded of something that you find over in the book of Isaiah in chapter 43, where God says, "Fear not, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by your name. You are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And through the rivers, they shall not overflow you. When you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned, nor shall the flame scorch you. For I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel." Lord, how in the world am I going to handle this? God answers, you can't handle it, so let go of it. I know your brain needs a place to put this anxiety, so why don't you leave it with me? Now, of course, that's easier said than done, and I suppose that's one of the reasons that I tend to write things down, because I can always go back and remind myself that the problem isn't mine anymore. I gave it away to somebody else, and now it's stored in the best place possible. In the 23rd Psalm, easily the best known and most loved of all the Psalms, David says this, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. For you are with me, your rod and your staff, they comfort me." Take a careful look at what that says. As you likely know, because it's been read on 1,000 special occasions, the poem begins with the words, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." So when it mentions a rod and a staff, it's actually using pastoral language. It's a picture of a shepherd guiding his sheep, bringing order out of chaos. Left to themselves, sheep will scatter. They'll go off in a dozen different directions. That's why sheepdogs are so valuable. They know how to corral the sheep and keep them going in the right direction. This psalm uses the language of order, and it's better than a sheepdog. This is God moving the random blocks of your life into something that will make a lot more sense. All right, it's time for one last break, and then I'll come back and wrap things up.
Dragons, beasts, cryptic statues. If you've ever read Daniel or Revelation and come away scratching your head, you're not alone. Voice of Prophecy's free Focus on Prophecy guides are designed to help you unlock the prophetic mysteries of the Bible and deepen your understanding of God's plan for you and the world around you. You can study online or request them by mail. Visit BibleStudies.com and start bringing prophecy into focus today.
Welcome back. It's Authentic with Sean Boonstra and the Voice of Prophecy.
Well, there you go. I've done it again. I've blathered on and on and on until I've just about run out of time. But maybe before we're finished, let me go back to the tunneling boyfriend one last time. I really don't know what it is about that tunnel that guy loves, because we've never met. But I can guess. I might be wrong, but I can guess. There's nothing down there under the ground except for hard work and his private thoughts. He's down there bringing order out of chaos. And that just happens to be one of the deepest needs that you and I have. And this is really one of the reasons that I've learned to love reading the Bible. This is a bluntly honest book, and it reveals the human condition exactly the way it is. It doesn't sugarcoat it. You'll find all the same trauma that you find in 21st century life. This book talks about things like murder and betrayal and even rejection by family. In fact, the gospel accounts show us that Jesus himself went through all those things and more. Far from being pie in the sky, this book is an honest, a real depiction of what human life is like. But then it offers us some peace of mind, a way to organize the trauma of this world and begin to make sense out of it. In Psalm 46, the psalmist writes these words, "God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, even though the earth be removed and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though its waters roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with its swelling." Look, I'd love to sit here today and tell you that I've mastered all of this, but that wouldn't be true. I'm still learning how to control anxiety, but I can tell you this. Knowing that somebody out there can still see the sense of my life on the days that I can't, that makes all the difference in the world. Because now I've got somewhere to take my chaotic thoughts and file them. There's somewhere to put them. I have full permission to lean into the pain of this life and confront it, which many people will tell you is one of the fastest ways to begin the healing process. Some people look for distractions in an effort to cheat their grief and anxiety. But as a good friend of mine pointed out after tragically losing his wife, it is almost always better to face your grief head on. Take it. Place it under the heading God's problem and leave it with him. Now it's organized, it's categorized, and at least partially dealt with. "Be anxious for nothing," Paul once wrote, "but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God, and the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus." You know, in the opening chapter of the book of Ezekiel, the prophet saw this whirlwind. I mean, the very definition of chaos. And it was a prophetic representation of the world he found himself living in. He was in Babylonian exile. But then he looked up above the storm, and he saw the throne of God up there and realized there is someone out there who can handle it. You know, some people go and dig tunnels. Other people like me go and shovel heavy, wet snow or do something physical to help organize their thoughts. Other people learn the ancient art of prayer. And as they learn to pray, they discover something remarkable. You can take all the chaos of this world, the chaos, the pain, the anxiety of your life, and hand it over to somebody who's got it under control. And at that moment, you'll discover you really can have peace of mind. Thanks for joining me for today's episode of Authentic. We'll see you again next week.
You've been listening to Authentic, sponsored by Voice of Prophecy. Remember, you can listen every week right here at the same time. And thank you. Authentic is funded by listeners just like you. You can support at voiceofprophecy.com. That's also where you can find all the episodes you missed, or where you can listen again. That's voiceofprophecy.com.